from, you know, whoever wants to share later about how the presents were a delight to have in the class. So, you know, it's always nice to have an assistant because, you know, I'm so focused on teaching and being at the front of the room. And, you know, you have that sort of 360-degree overview of the room and what's going on. So much appreciated.
It's a bit particular to assist in a retreat because it's not the same thing as a yoga class. I think it's an all... process for everybody. So if ever I, in any way of my presence or actions, if ever I disturb somebody or it wasn't my intention.
Yeah. Thanks, so, sir.
Thank you for that. Yeah. And, you know, and that's a hard edge to play because some people do want assistance and others don't. And then you know, it's kind of like you're walking that fine line. So that's a little bit of an art, too. Yeah. So, and I wanted to thank you all for your dedication and commitment and showing up. You know, it's not easy to show up at 5:45 in the morning in the middle of November. You know, because you know we're mammals and we're hibernating creatures, and this is the time of year when. You know, I don't know about you, but I just want to curl up under the covers. But you kept showing up, so.
And so did you.
And I, did, and I had to. You didn't really have to. But you did. And so, was the yoga helpful? I mean, in terms of... Okay, good. And, you know, some of you were here last year, and we took a vote to go to have... one more day, and you were there, Nancy, and it did make a difference.
Absolutely.
Having that extra day.
Absolutely.
Too. Yeah, and probably another day too, and another day. But it's interesting, as you know, to teach, because the first couple of classes that I taught felt like the time went by, and I felt like I hardly got anything in. And I don't know if you noticed this morning how much yoga we were able to do in so little time, you know? So you get used to the routine, and there's this kind of, it's almost like this fluidity that starts to happen. So I don't know if you've noticed that as a teacher, but I definitely felt that. So I'll talk a little bit about maybe just some tips for yoga in daily life. So your yoga practice is portable. And it doesn't have to be a special time when you roll out your mat, although, you know, that's wonderful if you can and you have time in your life for that. But you can actually bring little bits of yoga throughout the day. So say you're at work and, you know, you could do a little desk yoga, rolling your shoulders, you know, some of the head movements and so on, you know. So if you're feeling kind of tensed up or, you know, starting to feel like too much screen time. You know, like Daryl was saying, in addition to taking a few mindful breaths, you can also just move just a little bit. And exhaling through the mouth is also, you know, the nervous system responds right away. Shall we try that? Try it again? So breathe in as you draw your shoulders up to your ears. A couple more times. Inhaling. Notice what happens. It's like magic. Just like that. So, and it's free. And it's available at any time during the day. We just have to remember sati. Another thing is, I hope I was really intentionally bringing in the doing practice, the tapping, and the joint rotation series, which these are like 5-minute practices that you can do. I do them, you know, I floss my teeth and then I have fairly good-sized bathroom, but, you know, and I just do it right then and there. No need to pull out the yoga mat. So if you only have 5 minutes, you might want to try those, you know, bring those home, start doing them. Because I find yes, please.
What did you call that?
So the tap, tap, tap one, that's it's based on Japanese doin. So if you look it up, D-O, I think it's D-O-I-N. And it's, I just took little bits of it, you know. It's a complete practice. So you can Google it. But that or the joint rotation series, and just weave it into your mornings, you know. Because I find, frankly, like 5 or 10 minutes of yoga a day, that consistency, a lot better than doing one 90-minute class a week, you know. I mean, it's great to go and do a yoga class, don't get me wrong. But if you can weave in a few minutes every day, even better. And then if you have a little bit more time, I really encourage you to create a little home practice for yourself. Even if you're new to yoga, check in just the intuiting. It's like, you know, I get up in the morning and I ask myself, well, what do I need? You know? And sometimes, you know, the mind will create a whole thing. Well, I've got to do 5 sun salutations, you know, that sort of thing. But if I really check in deeply, it's like, I just need to lay down, or I just need to draw my knees into my chest, especially at this time of year when it gets so cold. And, you know, the body doesn't necessarily want to move so much. So it could be nice to do a little bit of yoga and then sit. Really nice to bring your, you know, infuse your mindfulness into your body as a whole. You know, just doing some movement and then sitting can inform your sitting practice. Can allow you to drop in a little bit more easily. Well, try it. See if that's true. I mean, it was true for me, but you may want to discover that for yourself. Other suggestions. So really checking in, like, what do I need? What do I really need? And that may be very different from a concept or an idea about what you should be doing, because, you know, that's what you did in yoga class 3 days ago, and that's what the teacher said or whatever. But it may not be true. You know, you may really be needing something else for yourself. And then I assume some of you have yoga teachers, but maybe some people don't. And if you're looking for a yoga teacher, my suggestion would be to go around and try different styles of yoga and then see what resonates for you. You know, especially if you live in a large enough community where there, you know, there's several yoga studios. Don't settle for the first one. Yeah. And I was trained in the Kripalu tradition, so there's hundreds of Kripalu teachers now throughout North America, actually around the world. And if you live in a large enough city like Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, you can Google kripalu.org and then put in your zip code, and you'll get a directory of teachers in your area. So you may want to do that. So, that's all I got for now.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, David. Yeah. I also want to express my gratitude to you, David. Yeah. I think that you just really added so much. I wasn't able to make most of the sessions. I just so enjoy your practice, because there's so much. Not only is it gentle and at the same time skillful, it's so warm, and the humor and humanity that's there. And Verna, thank you so much. It was really a great support, and I appreciate your sensitivity. (Clears throat) there are, in terms of practice, practice is the path, the Buddhist path that's outlined in the Four Noble Truths, is talked about. You know, there are eight path factors, and they're grouped into three categories. Lots of groupings and numbers in Buddhism, and you know, sometimes it's good to think about, like, what are the factors that make a complete practice? Because very often in the West or in North America here, where people are introduced to meditation or to some mindfulness practice, and think that meditation stands on its own, but not in the Buddhist tradition. The three path factors are wisdom, ethics, and meditation, and those are the order in which it's outlined in the Eightfold Path. Usually, it's taught with ethics first, and then wisdom and meditation. But as I said, in the West, often it's practiced just meditation. So it's hard to, you know, understand what's happening in meditation if you're not getting, you know, the wisdom teachings and also the ethical teachings are really, really important. And you know, as we talked about the five precepts in the beginning of the retreat, and the essence of them is non-harming, ahimsa, in Sanskrit, and the wisdom teachings are, you know, I've been sharing wisdom teachings, the insight into the emptiness, the impermanence, the causes of suffering. So there's so much available in terms of nourishing yourself with teachings, on in terms of books and online talks. Dharma Seed, if you're not familiar with it, is a wonderful website which has thousands of talks, and the talks that I gave on retreat will be available through our website, True North Insight website, and it leads into a special Dharma Seed kind of room that we have for our teachers. And then the meditation is what we've been practicing. So you know, it's a balanced diet of meditation, ethics, and wisdom. You know, I guess primarily in the area of ethics, you know, it overlaps into other things, the other two as well, is the whole practice of relationships, or practice in relationships. And so much of our lives is in relationship, and especially the relationships which are closest to us are so fraught with difficulty, or can be, because we bring so much of ourselves into them, and so do the other people, and so it can happen that that sometimes the relationships that we spend most time in, we're not our best selves in these relationships, and we can be very reactive, defensive, and it's, you know, it's possible to kind of do a reset in relationships. I've done it. I've done it with my spouse. I've done it with my son. when things are seem to just be, there's just stuff coming in and it just doesn't, like the love doesn't seem to be holding the space for us to express our hearts, our tenderness, and to be vulnerable. Things come up and kind of just, it's like, gets like polluted. and you know, it's possible to just call it and to have the honesty and the open-heartedness to say, just to say, you know, I'm feeling that this is there's something happening between us, and I'm not that happy about it, and can we sit down and talk about it. I think a really important principle, something I learned most clearly and strongly and powerfully from my children, is to let people be who they are, and that can. That can be difficult, but it's really the first precept, to not do violence to people and creatures. You know, to not try to put someone in a box that they don't fit into. And when we do that, it really. The other side of that, so the positive side of that, is that we are opening our eyes and our hearts to who this person really is. There's a story I've told many times, and if you've heard it before, then you're going to hear it again. And it's a story from Joanna Macy, this wonderful woman I mentioned before, who's a deep ecologist and Dharma teacher and activist. And she's in her 80s and she's going strong. She's amazing. And she told a story of when her boyfriend at the time, whose name was Fran, she and him decided to get married. They decided that they were going to make that commitment, and they went to visit a friend who's also a minister, and they told him, and they asked him to, you know, to perform the ceremony, and he agreed. And he said, and the blessing I'm going to give you right now is, may you always be strangers to each other. Which, interesting, so it's kind of takes you by surprise. It's to underscore that we don't know who this person is in this moment. We don't really know who they are, even though we may see them every day. We don't even really know who they are. You know, we're always surprising ourselves, and really, when we look deep into our own hearts and minds, you know, we find openness, silence, potentiality, always something emerging. You know, if we think we know who we are, we've put ourselves in a box, and because we're always changing, and something new is always coming through us. And it's also true of the people around us, and and the people, including the people who are close to us. I think with children, you need to learn that. If you're going to see your children, then there you see that they're always emerging, that they're changing, they're growing, they're becoming somebody new, they're learning new things, they're bringing that into the relationships. And even when they're grown up, you know, it's true. So that capacity to allow the person to express themselves in the way that is authentic and true to them, and to take the gift from that. You know, I was talking to David earlier, and we've known each other for many, many years, and we know each other's spouses also, and I was describing how, you know, my husband is very different from the way I am temperamentally. He teaches physics. He's a physicist, and he's very kind of methodical in the way that he thinks and in the way he acts, and he's a great teacher and great physics teacher because of that. You know, he's always, you know, wants to be clear that he's covered the ground, and any question is welcome, you know, and it's not a stupid question, and he often approaches other kinds of things in that way, and you know, I'm a totally different kind of thinker. Like I'm kind of more intuitive person, so I, you know, okay, I got it. What's next? No, I haven't explained it yet. I've learned to just, okay, that's, I don't want to disrespect his approach, and you know, there's this story I've told a couple of times about how, you know, he used to, or he still does often, like when we're going somewhere or when I'm going somewhere, you know, and he'll kind of go through a checklist. Did you bring this? Did you bring that? And I, for years, I felt. Come on, don't you think I'm competent? Of course, I took it because I had in my life experienced not being respected and kind of diminished. And so I was projecting that onto him. But he said, no, he's been a pilot in his life. He flew a little Cessna for years, and he said, "Oh, it's like, you know, it's like the pilot and co-pilot. They go through their checklist. Got this, done this. You know, it's not personal." Mm-hmm. And so I finally got it. You know, after years, I finally got it that it wasn't about me. And so there's so many different ways that we can trigger each other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and then we take things personally and put an intention behind things that maybe isn't there. And so to bring that quality of mindfulness into our relationships, that freshness, that, you know, really seeing with fresh eyes, you know, who are you today? And not only the people that we live with, the people that we work with, the people that are our neighbors, you know, to be interested in who they are. And it's it's really a practice. I can't say I always do it perfectly. A True North Insight, we are an organization, we are a board, and we have board members, and we meet regularly throughout the year, and I think that we have a fairly good culture as a board where there's kindness, and we check in with each other at the beginning of the meeting, how's your life? What's happening in your life? So that bringing that care, I think about how I feel when people really, it's not just say, how you doing, but, remember things about, that I've told them. And so that means they've really listened. Mm-hmm. So it's such a rich practice. And of course, just bringing that quality of loving kindness, goodwill, may you be well, thinking of people in our lives with love, with compassion, with joy for their good fortune. It's a practice for us, and it's a practice, and we bring those qualities when we've rejoiced in somebody's good fortune instead of getting into a kind of a jealous state or a competitive state about it. We show up in a whole different way in that relationship. So many, many practices in daily life. And so this is maybe you've been thinking about things that you're going home to, or things that you're not sure how to handle, or you have questions, or comments. Maybe something came up. We're going to, at the end, after this, we're going to form a circle, and in terms of sharing about our experience on retreat, there's going to be an opportunity for people to share, if you'd like to, about what maybe came up for you on retreat, whether it's was something, was wonderful, or maybe it was something very difficult. They both could be quite valuable. So, but for now, just maybe focusing comments or questions about going home, and to either David or myself, whichever.
So I'm gonna go home, and my friends and family are gonna say, "How was it?" And there's gonna be some great conversations, and it's gonna be awesome. But the one person who is gonna be the most interested is gonna be the hardest conversation. Because they're going to want to know every single detail. And how do you express what you've been through without sounding preachy? I don't think anyone else that I'm going to talk to would anything come across as preachy, but this person who is the most important, I don't want to come across like I feel like I know everything or judging them, but I feel like I've learned things about them and me and mm-hmm.
It comes through to me a couple things is I would really stay focused on your own experience. Stay grounded in what you experienced rather than what you think you understood about the relationship. And what's good about it, what's not so good about it. I think that's probably the difficult part. Yeah. And feel free not to share. When I came off a long retreat once, one of the teachers said, you know, if somebody asks you, you know, like casually, yeah, how was that retreat? You know, I could say, it was great. If they're really interested, they'll ask more. And this teacher said, let them ask three times. Yeah. Sometimes the Buddha wouldn't respond until somebody asked three times. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, if they're really curious and they're really interested, you know, then tell them. But you don't have to kind of just open it up for everybody. There's, you know, there's a word, for many years I had a Christian practice, and one of the beautiful lines from scripture was about Mary as she began to understand what she was being called into, and it was that she kept these things and treasured them in her heart. And that spoke to me. It's like we don't need to give away everything that we've kind of touched, and some of it's quite, you know, ephemeral or nuanced or maybe not quite clear, it's just emerging into our understanding, and I used to have this. I'm not saying this is you, but I used to have this predisposition or predilection that I would want to talk about, you know, all of my inner stuff to people, And I gradually began to realize that, you know, I was just wanting to share what was precious to me, but there's some discernment that can happen about the time and the place and the appropriateness and of the relationship. I don't know. Do you want to follow up with a question? Does that help, or maybe David? Do you want to add something?
I'll speak from my own experience. When I first started going on retreats at places like IMS and my tendency was to, just like within 24 hours, just kind of just talk to like my wife or friends, and you know, tell them all about the experience. And what I found was I was dissipating a lot of energy, and it would have been more skillful to hold it in. And like Daryl was saying, we don't always know what happens on retreat. Sometimes, you know, it's like nothing happens. And then 3 weeks or a month later, it's like we have an insight, or, you know, something comes up. So I think it's important to hold that. It's like a container, mm-hmm. and not letting it leak. So be judicious, I guess, is my advice in terms of, you know, sharing information about the retreat.
In our group session, we talked about soaking yourself in mindfulness so you can't be ignited. So if something that would normally set you off set me off with a response, and great response. Instead, I'm soaked in mindfulness now, and I'm gonna take a step back.
Yeah.
But what does that look like? Do I ignore the comment or the statement or the thing that would normally set me off? Do I say, I'm not responding to this anymore, or how do you, what do you say to the person? Because in my case, it's certain statements and things that are said that I've been reacting badly to. So what do I say to that person instead of getting mad at them, but not reacting?
Well, you know, I would not want to give you a formula, but you know, there are some really good trainings in communication that, like nonviolent communication. Have you heard of that, Marshall Rosenberg? Really, really helpful. If you're looking for frameworks to help you remember how to respond. Not only not react, but to respond, you know. And I think it's okay just to be silent and maybe just make an I statement, you know, like that felt harsh, or that felt judgmental to me, or, you know. But I think part of the empowering that's going to have to happen is that you're going to have to discover for yourself, you know, what you need to say and what you need to do. And I think that's part of, you know, you need to find it in yourself. And you know, but there are also great places to get some advice, how to approach it non-violently, non-reactively. Yeah. Question or comment?
Oh, okay. Can I add something to this? Well, what I found is that just whatever that comment is coming in your way, that you don't like, check into your feelings. And if you feel sad or frustrated, communicate that. Because nobody can argue with how you feel. Because that's a fact. So I feel really sad that you said this. It makes me feel frustrated. You know? That's the I feel stuff.
Yeah.
And it seems to work. I use it with kids. And they use it, it works. It stops the argument. So, this is a different topic, but I was really hooked into that statement you made about respecting someone else's freedom. And if you don't, you're actually doing fine.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way. I never thought that you were actually doing violence. Respecting that freedom. So I'm really fascinated with it, and I'm full of emotion when I hear that in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
So because I think meditation is about attaining freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So basically respecting your journey. Because you want freedom for yourself, at least I do. This is about freedom from my condition. So the follow-up question is, how did you conclude that you're doing violence? I see it, but where did you get the notion that you're doing violence to that person?
Mm. Well, when we want to change somebody to conform to our expectations, you know, when we want to change somebody to conform to our preferences, mm-hmm. then it's doing violence to who they are. And it's not nurturing, you know, the unique being that they are. They're manifesting in, you know, they're blooming in their, you know, they're a sunflower, and I was looking for a lily or whatever, you know, and letting them bloom. And I think that that's what we want. I think that's what we all want. You know, when we're accepted as who we are, right? You know, that when we're just received, and I mean, that's the best thing that we can do for kids, is to love them for who they are, and listen to what they, you know, what they get excited about, and you know, listen to what they get scared about, and give them the encouragement and the support to grow and blossom. So, you know, but we all need that, even grown-up kids.
Sure. I thought you read it somewhere in some scripture. This is your own.
Well, it's an insight. I mean, it's from studying the precepts and thinking about them.
Okay.
Well, so to come back to this last comment and some things you said earlier about having a reset in a relationship or checking up on your board members, these conversations are possible with people who are capable of authenticity. And not everybody is capable of being authentic. Some people have developed either narcissistic or manipulative behaviors, are unable to speak the truth or be vulnerable. And now we're talking about respecting people how they are, not wanting to change them.
Mm-hmm.
But these, you know. So, yeah.
Well, good luck trying to change somebody who's narcissistic.
Well, we are in relationships with people who are abusive or.
Yeah.
And if you just tell them how you feel, these people will use your authenticity against you.
Mm. It can happen, yeah.
So it's complicated.
It is. And the point you make is very true and important. That so you know, we do need to bring discernment into our relationship and make choices about with whom we will be vulnerable. Is it safe, you know, to open our hearts and our, you know, and open ourselves to somebody who has shown in the past that they might abuse that openness. And so we do need to care for ourselves and protect ourselves. And you know, to the extent possible, minimize our contact and what we do with people who are hurtful. You know, I know sometimes it could have a neighbor, or it could have a boss, or a colleague at work who is a really, really difficult person. And You know, and I kind of think that that for me, like, I don't want to return, you know, like for like. I don't, like, if that person is nasty, I don't want to be nasty, because I don't feel good when I'm nasty. You know, I feel like I'm violating myself. But, you know, I will be probably civil, you know, and guarded. But, yeah, sometimes people surprise us too. I think it's good to always be ready to be surprised, to leave that little crack in the door, you know, and always be ready to be surprised and not close the box on somebody in total judgment. You're just, sometimes a kind gesture awakens something.
And sometimes it's okay not to pick up the ball.
And sometimes
it's okay not to pick up the ball.
Yeah. Sometimes it's okay not to pick up the ball.
It's a story that Daryl told about the Buddha.
Yeah, there was this other teacher who came to the Buddha and said, and accused him. He was very angry and accused him of, you know, teaching stuff that was wrong and the whole manner. I mean, he was just, you know, a whole lot of angry and a bit of a tirade, and the Buddha just listened, and then he asked this person, you know, when, because usually teachers were supported by offerings, you know, as we talked about this morning. And he said, you know, when you've had your offerings and you've eaten your fill, and then somebody comes with another bowl for you, you know, what do you do? He says, well, I don't take it. So he says, well, that's what I'm doing. It's yours, it's not mine, you know, I don't need to pick it up. And so, yeah, so that it can stay with them, you know, if it's anger, if it's you know, a kind of a distorted view of the world, or gossip, or, you know, all kinds of things that feel nasty, you know, and we don't want to take it in, so we can just say, I can stay with you.
In the interest of compassion and loving kindness, I often offer a second point of view if a person's discussing something negative for a person. And I've often been accused of being the devil's advocate. And so I struggle between not speaking my truth and being silent, or speaking my truth and it not really be heard.
Mm.
I don't know if you can comment on that.
Do you want to say anything? You have some thoughts about that, David?
No, I'll think about it.
Okay.
I've been thinking about it. I haven't come up with something.
An easy one.
I think that in some ways, people can get into a herd mentality. You know, like, we want to have one view. It's like this. And please don't tell me something that's going to upset my belief. you know, because I've got to figure it out. You know, I want to have it all figured out. And so the person who has the divergent view or says, well, yes, there's truth in that, and also, you know, we can look at this perspective, you know, does sometimes get blowback, and it can be really difficult. You know, I find that very often, I mean, it happens, you know, in certainly in politics and, you know, social issues that, you know, there's, depending on where you stand on the political spectrum, but there's a right way to understand things. And then what if you say, well, you know, there's actually some truth in another perspective, or there's something that we need to consider in another perspective. I mean, the truth of that is in the yin-yang, you know. There's always, you know, the wholeness of something always contains, it's not one way or another. There's always something to be learned from the other side. And when we want things to fit into a box of, you know, these are our beliefs and this is the right way, then inevitably, you know, people are excluded, people are pushed away, and then it creates, you know, people who feel resentful and not heard, and so I think it's important. I think it's important to consider other views. You know, I was trying to remember this. I know I read in one of the texts that the Buddha was falsely accused of something. I can't remember what. I'm going to Google it when I get home. The Buddha was falsely accused of something. And sometimes people are falsely accused, you know. But can we believe that? I mean, is there room for saying, well, not all accusations are to be believed? Maybe there's sometimes a person has a motivation to make a false accusation. And, you know, there are, as we just talked about, there are all kinds of people in this world. So, I think it's great to keep an open mind, but it doesn't necessarily make you popular. And sometimes it can take courage to say, you know what, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, and I also think it's important to consider this, and maybe, you know, the devil's advocate is a certain, I mean, the devil's advocate had, it comes from a history of something. It comes from a history of trying to present an opposing view and argue it wholeheartedly and maybe get something out of that. And it's from, I guess it's from ecclesiastical, you know, practice. But it's not necessarily for the devil. It's can be for the side of compassion and understanding and not marginalizing people. You know, like keeping a whole view. I was involved in politics when I was not politics but activism when I was 17, 18, 19. I lived down in the States and it was. There was a lot going on. And
it still is.
Still is, yeah. Still is. Different, but yeah. And I just, you know, like the... I wasn't particularly, you know, like a in a spiritual tradition at the time, but the blame and the anger, you know, and the rejection of any of the people on the other side, you know, really disturbed me. And I thought, well, this is a peace movement, and I don't feel this is about peace. You know, this was about blame and rejection. So, I mean, not to say that terrible things weren't being done, but to kind of reject, you know, a whole part of society, and it's more polarized than ever down there. So, yeah, but I think it's important what you do.
I won't strive to be popular.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
It goes back to respecting people's freedom and not trying to change them.
Yeah.
What you originally said.
Yeah.
So, even though you disagree, if the person's not open to being receiving an alternative argument, then you let it go.
Yeah.
Because you're respecting their freedom.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a practice that Joanna Macy used to do, or probably still does with people, in which, you know, she would take an issue and she would have three people talk about it. So say, you know, talking about deforestation, and somebody would take the part of the forest, you know, and would express, you know, sort of from the forest, you know, like the heart of the forest, and somebody might express else, I may not be remembering this exactly right, but somebody else might express the social issue about the forest, and somebody else would express the point of view of the lumber company, and they would need to listen to each other. And so, you know, if you're going to argue to preserve the forests, you also need to understand what people need who are cutting down the forests. Mm. And not just say you're bad, and because that doesn't lead to any kind of solutions.
So I don't know about others, but I found myself, and I'm wondering how to kind of carry this moving forward in my meditation practice, fluctuating between this sense of like, oh my God, I'm going to be so grounded and do all these great things, and then I'd be like, humility, I'm not special, I'm, you know, and just that rapid fluctuation, I would catch myself and I would laugh because it was so ridiculous, the kind of the dreams of grandiosity that I was going to do with being so grounded, and then, you know, and then this constant reminder of, you know, and that I really find so soothing, this sense of you're not and so, yeah, I don't know what really to do with that fluctuation.
Yeah, I think that's so important to remember. Yeah, we're not special. We're not special. Nobody's special. We're all human. We're all, you know. But, you know, the ironic thing, the funny thing is that when you have that thought, I'm so grounded, you're so not grounded. You're totally outside of yourself. Grounded is present. And then when we're present, then we're not creating a self. You know, we just are.
So I'm brand new at, well, fairly new at this, and I read about this, but I experienced it more in this, my first retreat, where the more you look, the more you realize how nuts the human mind is. And, so does that mean I'm grounded?
It's an insight. It's actually one of the first insights. No, seriously, meditators who are new discover this called the crazy mind. The you know, just seeing the noise in the mind and how we just keep just chatter, and we're with the breath for a second or two, and then, you know, we're off again. And then so, but just the fact that you see that you, it's like, wow, I didn't know how crazy my mind really is. That's
I suspected, but
that's different from actually, you know, spending a few days on retreat and really seeing that. But that's progress, right? So that's to be seen as progress on the path, rather than, oh, I'm a failure, you know, like, what's the matter with me, you know? Because common humanity, we all are crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing I'm kind of gaining comfort in, is that I'm not alone in that.
Yeah. Chatter, no, you're not alone.
Practical feedback on the retreat, again, my first retreat, was that you talked about it being longer than you've been in the past.
Yeah.
I'm really glad it was longer, because I didn't settle in at all until yesterday afternoon.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Is a day shorter, I want to reach that point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you're not alone there.
Another feedback for me, I'm very physically active, so the yoga and the walking.
Okay.
I couldn't have survived without those components.
Yeah.
Really helpful.
Yay.
Tying together the body and the mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, a lot of people find that. And this yoga and meditation retreat is a door opener for people who have been doing yoga for a while and then want to explore what is it to be silent, what is it to be still. You know, so it's a doorway for, and it's also a doorway for meditators who've been sitting for a long time and they realize that, you know, it's beneficial to move. It is beneficial. It does aid in the practice. So, yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
One more quick
kind
of feedback comment as a newbie here. The silence, I have no problem being silent. I've done long trips I've had before, or weeks where I'm just by myself in silence, that's not a problem. But the group dynamic was weird. Being around people who I hadn't talked to, made eye contact with, so the sense of these, beings, you know, that's a problem. Not like beings, these robots almost shuffling around like I was shuffling around. Yeah. And then we had the group session, and I was in the first group session we had. There was only, whatever, those 7 people. But just being able to look in the eye and hear the voice helped me have a whole different perspective about the environment, the context I was in, that these are people like me. That connection was not easy to make, right? Yeah. And then today, you know, there are more people talking, and it's like there's that kind of connection that's helpful. So I understand the silence. I wonder if at the beginning, before the meditation, there was a session like this, people could talk more. Like, there's the lunch, but you only get 3-4 people that you tend to talk to, right? For me, that would have been really helpful to have a group session, a little bit of eye contact, hear people's voices, and then go silent. For 4 days, I would feel different about the environment around me, feel more connected to humanity. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not trying to.
Yeah, that's great feedback, Robert. It's really interesting. I mean, it's something that you know, I've sometimes felt, and you know, we do. I do another retreat. I teach a retreat, co-teach with Jean Esther on relationships, and we have a bit more exchange before, and there's a lot of silence, but it's not so much it's not completely silent, but that's something I've often felt, and I remember on my first retreat exactly I felt that, you know, I felt like, who are these people, and
are they even people? That was the weird thing.
Yeah, you see people doing walking meditation.
Look at her shuffling slowly.
I know. You know, is this zombie land?
Yeah,
or Night of the Living Dead? Or I know. I remember that perception, and I think, you know, we have this form, and it works, and, you know, really well in many ways. And I think that, you know, that's it's a great suggestion, and I'm interested in knowing how we could adapt it. We'd need to maybe start earlier in the afternoon, but anyway, thanks for that.
Yeah. It just reminded me that I'm totally new to the silent retreat, but I did the mindfulness-based stress reduction program years ago, so I'm not new to meditation, but I remember, like, the room is so beautiful and peaceful when you see everyone sitting in a quiet and their eyes are closed, and it looks so peaceful, but I remember my teacher saying, well, that person's making their grocery list. Thinking about, you know, quite they just had with their husband. The person is having a moment of bliss and then it's gone. And, you know, and so knowing that maybe for people that are new coming in could set their mind at ease a little bit. But, and their mind is all over the place, probably, even though it looks so blissful.
Okay, so we, was there a question?
I had one, is there time?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to let me. The first was, just for the newbies, it would be nice to have some sort of a discussion. This is the first kind of longer retreat that I've done, and it would have been nice to have had something in the beginning, because I was didn't know what to expect, and that would have been helpful just to build on what you were saying. And also, I find it very helpful to talk about what to tell people about it, because I still don't know exactly what my thoughts are from the retreat. Like, I feel like it's still percolating, and I don't know if you guys have any comments about what to kind of expect in the days and weeks to come from the percolation. And the other is just sort of going back into the real world, that this is not the real world. You know, I've done day-long retreats where, you know, you leave with a sense of bliss, and then you know you're a nanosecond too long at the stop sign, and someone honks at you, and suddenly you're totally out of, you know, you're back to reality. So I don't have any comments about that.
I could say something.
There's
the teacher who's now in his 80s, but he's taught for a long time. And in my hometown of Boston, his name is Larry Rosenberg, wonderful teacher. And he often says on, you know, his skillfully teaches, and he says, when the retreat is over, exhale. Which means that it's over, and let it go, you know. You know, I think that's good advice. It's like it's happened and it's over, and now we go back to our lives and we live our lives. And of course, we may have insights and you know, later, and it's something about that retreat that helped me navigate through life in a better way, or in my relationships. But we don't have to. We can just leave, just exhale. Do you want to add to that?
Can I say something about that?
Yeah. Sure.
I find in my experience,
yeah,
people who have not done this have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So my daughter thinks I'm on a vacation. She calls it. She's like, "Do you want me to help you pack for your vacation?" People at work think I'm at a spa, right? Because I'm going to nature. I'm going to do some forest walking. There's going to be a beautiful view. Yeah. I'm going to do some meditation and some yoga. There's, I find, unless the people who know are the people in this room, and even if you never talk to them, you know, they're the ones who know what happened. So I find it not very useful anymore to try and describe it or to try and explain. I'm like, oh, how was it?
Yeah.
Insightful.
Yeah.
And then I just sort of leave it at that. And it's mine. It doesn't, I don't have to try and explain or share it. And it's okay now. Yeah, before I think I tried, just didn't work. So I've learned to just keep it for myself and leave it. So
yeah,
I don't know if that's helpful.
And as to what to expect, I don't think there's any predicting. You know, it's just like it's your practice. We each have our own unfolding of the Dharma in our lives. And okay, so So Ruby, a comment, and I think, and one more, but we do have to wrap it up.
I was just going to add that, how it unfolds is different every time, and there's no predicting. I have one teacher who offers the advice when someone asks, how was the retreat, just to say, it was everything. and then for the people who say, well, what does that mean? They want to know more. I say, well, it was all the things retreats are. There was yoga. It was blissful at points. It was hard at other points. I slept well. The food was good. And, just to sort of leave it at that.
Yeah. And, as I mentioned, the people who are really curious, really interested in wanting to know what it was for you, are interested in spiritual practice, they'll probably ask again. Did you want to say something?
No, I'm just thinking that's exactly my experience. The people who are really interested, it's not hard to explain to them. Just they're very curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't have preconceived ideas about it.
I went to a retreat in the Ecology Retreat Center, and the advice the master would give us is ask them how their weekend was or how their rather than sharing your stuff first. Say, how was your week? That's a lot.
Yeah.
And then take the pressure off yourself.
Well, let me just read this little poem. It's called Praise Song, and it's by Barbara Crooker. Praise the light of late November, the thin sunlight that goes deep in the bones. Praise the crows chattering in the oak trees. Though they are clothed in night, they do not despair. Praise what little there's left, the small boats of milkweed pods, husks, hulls, shells, the architecture of trees. Praise the meadow of dried weeds, yarrow, goldenrod, chicory, the remains of summer. Praise the blue sky that hasn't cracked yet. Praise the sun slipping down behind the beech nuts. Praise the quilt of leaves that covers the grass. Scarlet oak, sweet gum, sugar maple. Though darkness gathers, praise our crazy fallen world. It's all we have, and it's never enough.
Mm-hmm.